All right, class, we have made it as far as the early 1900s in the United States, and we're talking about the history of outdoor recreation and forest recreation more specifically, and how it's gotten to where it is. So, we kind of left our discussion at the Great Depression, which was a golden era for conservation under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps. A lot of great work happened. But World War II happened immediately after, 1941 to 1945, which completely changed the progress of how we took stock of things like outdoor recreation at a societal kind of scale, right? A lot of folks are busy either off war fighting or supporting the war effort in various ways. So let's sort of fast forward to about 1945, 1946, and many, many soldiers are coming home, at least the ones who survived. And those soldiers returned to their wives and families and made lots and lots of babies. We call that generation the baby boomer generation, right? So the baby boomers were the first American generation that really, really exploded outdoor recreation into what we understand it to be today. Okay? So, we're looking at the slide entitled 1900s Confrontation Phase. Okay? So, in the year 1945 or so, we start making lots and lots of babies, and you can see from the graph on this slide that there are absolutely a whole bunch more recreationists in the 50s. In fact, overall levels of outdoor rec in the United States doubled from the 1940s to the 1950s, and then doubled again between the 50s and the 60s, and then doubled again between the 60s and 70s, and only into the 1980s did that doubling rate, that exponential growth, start to level off just a bit, okay? So, between 1940 and the 2000s, 2010, the aughts, a huge, huge growth on the order of hundreds of millions of recreation visits just in the United States alone has happened. And that's a pretty big deal, right? It changes from the perspective of we should probably take a look at these trails every once in a while to make sure they're safe and they're taking people where folks want to go and they're not too difficult and so forth, to, man, we really have to figure out something to provide good trails, plural, trail networks, for the millions of people that might visit our national park this year alone, okay? So huge change in how that has happened in the past 50 to 70 years. Right about now is when you want to start reading Chapter 3 in your Jensen and Guthrie book. So, do please take a look at that. Alright, next up. In the 1940s and 50s, those baby boomers were babies and little kids. By sort of the early 1960s, they are young adults in their 20s, and they have a lot of energy and a lot of capacity based on the post-war economic expansion of the United States. A lot of capacity to afford things like outdoor recreation, and a lot of technological advancement to not have to use heavy steel items and heavy canvas duck items. So cotton cloth treated to be waterproof is effective, but very, very heavy. These days we use lightweight technical stuff, right? And that increases where we can go and how fast we can get there. Okay, so by the 1960s, since the baby boomers are showing up and just pounding some of these places into the ground by walking all over the place and feeding wildlife and so forth, sort of consensus was growing among professional foresters and park rangers and interpreters and administrative staff that the American approach to outdoor recreation management needed to change somewhat. So the idea here is that we start seeing a lot of legislation in the 1960s roughly coinciding with sort of the first environmentally focused regulations as well. Okay? So, in 1960, we start off a very busy time for legislation as it concerns outdoor rec with the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act. So this primarily pertains to the Forest Service, but it's sort of a legislative perspective of the conservationist approach to administering and providing outdoor recreation. So, what does that mean? We're going to manage our national forests in specific for timber, range, watershed, fish and wildlife habitat, and for recreation. And where those things kind of don't automatically pull us in the same direction, where they are possibly opposed in some way, we're going to have to find some kind of happy medium or balance in between, or maybe not quite so happy, right? A compromise is where everyone loses. Just kidding. Not really. Okay, In 1962, we get a very famous book called Silent Spring by this lady, Rachel Carson, who was a biologist. Pretty famous lady in terms of the early environmental movement circles in the United States, because she wrote this book that tried to capture the idea that, wow, our use of industrial pesticides is just wiping out all kinds of insects. Not just the ones that are we consider bad and are eating our crops, but all kinds of other stuff too. So the title of the book, Silent Spring, refers to all the birds that are no longer around because the insects they feed on are no longer around, or the pesticides that are getting into the insects and then getting into the birds are bioaccumulating and killing them off, right? So one pretty famous example of what she's trying to get at with this book is the idea that DDT, a pesticide, bioaccumulates and moves its way up the food chain and shows up in animals like bald eagles. And bald eagles were for a while in real danger in terms of population size and long-term viability because the shells of their eggs that they laid would be made thinner by the presence of DDT in particular, the egg-laying mother's body. Right, so thin-shelled eggs break very easily, leads to natality, or reduced natality, that is, a reduced successful birth rate among those very fragile eggs. So Rachel Carson's one person, one researcher, sort of hip to this and trying to sound the early alarm bell that we can't just use pesticides all over the place, sort of a blanket application type thing. Okay, we see parallels today with colony collapse disorder and lots of recently careful scientific connections between neonicotinoid-based pesticides and pollinator loss, like honeybees, for example. So we use honeybees in an industrial farming context, but they're sometimes trying to pollinate plants that have just been hosed down with insecticides, and that's not so good. Same idea, and we're really catching it for the first time in the early 1960s with books like Silent Spring. Okay? A couple of years later, in the 1964 time frame, we've got the Wilderness Preservation System established. So, in 1916, we set up the U.S. National Park Service, which administers, protects, and creates new national parks. The Wilderness Preservation System is not specifically the domain of the U.S. National Park Service. So the Forest Service manages a whole bunch of wilderness. In particular, here in southern Illinois, most of the wilderness areas actually run through Shawnee National Forest and were created as chunks sort of taken out of general forest designation or general national forest designation and designated as wilderness. But they're also still considered part of the national forest. It's complicated, but what the Wilderness Preservation System did was try to set aside the least developed sections of parks, forests, wildlife refuges, monuments and so forth, and make sure they stay that way, that is, minimally developed. So very little permanent sign of human presence, structures, anything mechanized, that stuff generally not at all allowed unless there is a highly compelling reason to use it. So no mechanized transport means no heavy power equipment for building and maintaining trails. It also generally means no mountain biking, which a lot of people are not so happy about. But it does mean lots of horseback riding, backpacking, and the assurance that you're not going to run into things like strip malls or strip mines inside the wilderness area. Okay? In the following year, we got a very important piece of legislation, one good example of a whole class of legislation designed to figure out ways to help pay for all of these parks that we've created, and forests and wildlife, other protected areas that we've created over the past century or so. Okay? So the Land and Water Conservation Act provides a fee structure or a tax structure to take money from essentially the public and plow it into things like conservation and preservation efforts. In specific, this particular pot of money could be used for acquiring new places to protect. All right, so a lot of younger national parks and forests and so forth have been funded by programs like LWCA. So we see this today in terms of things like an extra dollar you pay for your Conserve Nature license plate with a picture of a bird on it or maybe a mountain in the background kind of thing. That dollar and the extra dollar that everybody else who chooses to have that license plate gets thrown into a pot of money statewide or nationwide, and that money goes to paying rangers, buying property and setting it aside as parks and so forth. that's kind of how that workflow goes. Okay. Now, this year, the year in which this lecture is recorded at least, 2014, is the 50th anniversary of Wilderness, right? 1964, 2014, subtract one from the other, you had 50 years. That's a big deal. So a lot of places have been promoting the local wilderness areas that not everybody necessarily knows about very heavily with the effort and intent of trying to get more folks aware of, excited about, connected to the wilderness in our own backyards. So here in Southern Illinois, we have a whole bunch of wilderness areas. That is, I think Shawnee National Forest has 6 or 7 designated wilderness areas, which is a lot east of the Mississippi. And Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge, I believe, has one as well. So right in our backyard, within an hour or two, we've got lots more wilderness than most people have. Okay? So, enjoy. Let's see. So 1964 was a busy year. We had a lot of stuff going on sort of in that 2, 3, 4 year time period, all right? So in 1965, we rolled together stuff like the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, which will show up in 1968. In 1968, we also get the National Trails System Act. In 64, of course, we get the Wilderness Preservation System. Between all these and a couple of other sort of smaller scope legislative efforts, all of these together get lumped into an open space system. And for the first time, we have enough protected areas, enough national parks and forests sort of next to each other that you can consider it as a landscape, not as individual places. And we call this the open space system. Okay? So let's go back to a couple of those bits of legislation that we just mentioned very briefly. So the National Trails System Act sets up, in particular, the National Park Service as the administrator of very long trails. So we have national scenic trails, like the Appalachian Trails, runs from Georgia to Maine, like we talked about earlier. There's also the Pacific Crest Trail, which runs from the southern border of, I believe it's California, right bordering Mexico, all the way up to the Canadian border. It's 2,600 miles long, maybe 27. And we also have the Continental Divide Trail running north-south from, let's see, Canada to, oh goodness, southern Colorado? Maybe further south, something like that? It must be further south. It's 3,100 miles long, so pretty long trails. And the National Trails System Act sets up those scenic trails as okay, it sets aside funding, it sets aside sort of authority for the Park Service to advocate for the creation of these big, long trails, maintain them, and so forth. And we also have, in addition to scenic trails, we have recreation trails, which might not be so sort of wild and off in the woods or up along a mountain range like the Sierras for the Pacific Crest Trail. They can be a little bit closer to civilization, sometimes a bit shorter, a little bit more heavily developed. And we also have, let's see, scenic trails, recreation trails, historic trails. So, if you've ever heard of the Lewis and Clark Trail, or the Trail of Tears, these would be trails that try to capture some aspect of history, like Lewis and Clark's journey out west, or the unfortunate Trail of Tears. This is one way to help tell the story of those particular and important events in history, but also a way to sort of link that historical interpretation with outdoor recreation in a way that can serve both purposes very effectively. So, at this point, you can actually walk the route that Lewis and Clark took. Now, some of it's along roads, some of it's way off in the woods, some of it is you got to get across big rivers, just like Lewis and Clark did. All right, these are pretty big logistical undertakings for recreationists, but they're also pretty big logistical undertakings for the Park Service to manage. So it took an act of Congress to set aside the authority for them to be able to do that. Similar idea with the same year, 1968, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. So what this did was it took and examined stretches of river that were minimally developed in lots of places, mostly out west, but we do have a few out east these days, and tried to look at them kind of like watery trails, right? So the idea was that in the 1960s, we're starting to get the idea that riparian areas, that is, riverine systems and stream systems, are crucially important ecosystems, and if we can set some of them aside for recreation purposes, that's going to mean they're protected from more consumptive purposes like industry or mining, for example, can really change how the local fluvial hydrology works and its quality. Okay? A couple of years later, we get, let's see, NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. So if you ever see announcements, and these tend to be not on the front page, But if you ever see announcements about Shawnee National Forest, for example, changing how it's going to manage a big chunk of the forest, and as a result of those changes, they think there are going to be some pretty big ecological shifts or economic shifts for businesses and communities nearby and so forth, that all has to be done in public with a lot of public input and review and so forth. The National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA for short, N-E-P-A, helps set up that process and the set of requirements involved. Okay, so this is how a lot of work gets done for the Park Service, for the Forest Service, and so forth, because they have to document a whole bunch of stuff, right? They can't just shut off recreation or logging access to a section of a forest. They have to let everybody know way in advance. They have to do a whole bunch of scientific research or sponsor a bunch of research to make sure that it's not going to ruin the ecosystem, it's not going to have an undue negative effect on the local economy, and so forth. So this is often a slow and ponderous process. It can result in thousands of pages of documentation per project for some of the more contentious ones. But it does help shed some sunlight and get some funding into major management efforts. Okay. A couple years later, in 1973, we have the Endangered Species Act. That's pretty straightforward. But up until that point, we didn't have anything for it. So a lot of recreation is affected by and affects endangered species and their presence and distribution throughout protected areas. So, the 1973 Endangered Species Act really changes how we can recreate in a lot of these places. And it was another sort of beat on the drum for recreationists to start to understand that, wow, you know, when we show up at a place to hike, we're not just there and then we're gone and nothing's changed. We actually affect the ecosystems we move through, even temporarily, even quietly, even with a small sort of ecological footprint. There is still a footprint every time. Okay. That's an important principle we'll come back to sort of later in the class. 1976, we get the National Forest Management Act, which set up some planning frameworks, and we'll talk about those way later, in particular in some later classes, so you'll hear more about that. But we're starting to get a little bit more legislative structure about accommodating millions of recreationists at places like Yosemite National Park, Great Smoky Mountains National Park, 6+ million visits a year, sometimes as many as 8. All right, so that's a big deal. 1979, okay, this is 13 years after the Wilderness Act of what year? 1964. 1979, we get the Roadless Area Review and Evaluation Process, Phase 2, completed. And what this does is it opens up a whole bunch of areas like we have around here in southern Illinois that are east of the Mississippi. They're small, and they may have had some previous ubiquitous human use, like farming or logging, across the entire landscape, but not recently. What the RARE 2, or Roadless Area Review and Evaluation Phase 2 process did, was to say, okay, some of these places, they don't really look like wilderness right now, but it's really important for us to have wilderness areas that are closer to the most populous sections of the country, that is, east of the Mississippi, okay? So in order to do that, we're going to have to kind of lower our standards a little bit, so to speak, temporarily, for the criteria we use to define a place as wilderness, okay? So, this means that for the first time, places like Panther Den and Burden Falls, which are small, they're too small to absorb a 2-week backpacking trip on foot, which was one of the original criteria for inclusion as a wilderness area. Many of them have roads through them, old farm roads and old farmsteads. Those would be considered sort of forbidden for according to the criteria for wilderness creation originally in 1964. But once you start managing these places as wilderness, right, the roads are removed, the farmland is replanted or allowed to return naturally via forest succession to a more natural state. More natural, not necessarily natural, right? So we're going to be careful with our terms here. And eventually it starts looking like a pretty wild spot, even though it's been pretty heavily used in the Western civilization sense previously. All right, so a couple years after that, we get to the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, as it's referred to. This was a big deal. So this was a particular piece of protected area legislation that really affected outdoor rec. And it was pretty much entirely focused, as the name suggests, on Alaska. Shortened to ANILCA in the field of professionals, and basically what it did was it set aside so much land in terms of wilderness areas and wildlife preserves and so forth that the total land area as managed by the National Park Service doubled overnight, right? Alaska is a huge state. It's relatively lightly developed, which means that you can set aside gigantic tracts of land. Okay, so if you ever head up to or have ever headed up to Alaska, there's a whole lot of opportunity for you, but it's all also a pretty wild place. There's some pretty good stories going around up there. What Anelka also did was, and this is also important for Outdoor Rec, it tried to legislatively preserve sort of alternative lifeways, as they're called these days. So if you are an Inuit or an Eskimo, what Anelka tried to do was set aside for you specifically as a native Alaskan the right and the privilege to be able to hunt in traditional ways. So if your ancestors depended on caribou for food, reindeer for food, then you can still hunt them. Now, it gets a little bit complicated when the native Alaskans want to use, you know, four-wheelers and high-powered rifles instead of spears and stuff like that, but that's sort of a twitchy ethical debate that we'll engage in some upper-level classes. But for our purposes, we pretty much want to know that Anelka doubled the size of land relative to what the National Park Service was already managing overnight in 1980. That's a big deal, okay? Now, we call sort of the latter two-thirds from sort of the mid-30s to the year 2000 the confrontation phase in forest recreation management because this is where that conservation versus preservation sort of debate and early battle at Hetch Hetchy Dam pretty much exploded into a full-scale war of ideals. So we have the hardcore wilderness preservation folks, and they get the 1964 Wilderness Act and Rare 2 and so forth. The conservationists get the establishment of the Bureau of Land Management, which allows and manages places like big mines and sort of desertified areas out west, but also permits recreation and so forth, right? So big battles going back and forth on we should be elite and only allow highly trained recreationists out there, or we should try to get absolutely everybody out there, right? There's a lot of sort of locking of horns conceptually on that. We also see the introduction for the first time in human history of motorized outdoor recreation. So basically what motorized outdoor recreation does is it takes fossilized sunlight in the form of petroleum-based fuels and takes that energy and applies it to outdoor recreation. So instead of scaling a rock wall with your own hands and feet, you can now scale a rock wall in a Humvee, right? And this rapidly expands the range where you can recreate and rapidly, hugely diversifies the range of people now able to engage and enjoy an outdoor recreation in a lot of places. So it would take a long time to walk to Yosemite National Park, but you can drive there pretty fast. So motorized outdoor rec, not necessarily a problem, but it can bring with it some pretty heinous environmental impacts, primarily in the form of soundscape and chemical water pollution. Okay, so if you are riding around in your sand rail or dune buggy and you come down real hard on a rock, or if you're rock crawling with a Jeep and you shatter your crankcase or something like that, all those refined and synthetic chemicals basically sort of leach out into the ground, into the soil, and it's really, really, really hard to get that stuff out of the soil once it's in. Doubly hard once it gets into the water table. So we got to be real careful about that. Okay. Also throughout the 1900s, we see the application of things like materials engineering. So instead of having handcrafted birch bark canoes and strip-by-strip built wooden kayaks, for example, now we can just injection mold them in one big piece. They're basically bomb-proof, unless they're struck by lightning. Got some cool photos of that. Ask me for them if you're interested. Lots of different ways to sort of take materials and make them more rugged, much cheaper, much more accessible to lots of folks. What this does is it also effectively lowers the skill barrier, right? So you have to be very, very careful with a birch bark canoe. You don't have to be very careful at all with an aluminum canoe. You can just sort of beat it to heck, and maybe some of you have been in aluminum canoes and have been beaten to heck and left behind chunks of the canoe on the rocks in the bottom of the stream. Okay? We also get, in the 1950s forward, with the widespread adoption of the television, mass media popularization. So, TV shows and commercials can both be used to market the idea behind outdoor recreation. That is, it's good for you. America has recreation resources like no other country in the world. And hey, if you want to do it, let's do it. Okay? So we see these days, it's really moved to social media and online. But back in that time, 50s, 60s, 70s, and so forth, we started seeing movies and documentaries about nature. And it very commonly, the nature shots for shows like Wild America, for example, hosted by Marty Stauffer, if you remember him, if you're old enough to remember him, also, in some cases, showed people nearby. And so this sort of helped popularize the idea that, wow, you know, okay, Yosemite exists as a sort of notional or abstract concept in my head, but, oh, that's what it looks like, and there are people there. There are roads. Hey, honey, let's go, right? So, right around the time the mass media popularization of outdoor recreation is starting to spin up is also when the baby boomers are sort of being created by the bazillions and start showing up at these places around 20 years later. Okay? What else? Let's see. We got a couple of key figures we want to make sure we cover for the latter two-thirds of the 20th century, the 1900s. All right? So Frederick Law Olmsted was the guy that helped design Central Park. We talked about that in the last unit. He also helped design a whole bunch of the facilities for the first national park. So, for example, if you've ever been on a road called Skyline Drive in any of the big national parks, Frederick Law Olmsted probably either directly helped to design that road so that as you come around each curve, you get a new beautiful vista out the window. That didn't happen by accident, right? He helped sort of come up with those ideas. And his students, his pupils, his influence on the field of landscape architecture helped set up a lot of visitor centers and areas around, develop campgrounds and stuff like that. It's kind of all bearing his conceptual fingerprint. We've already talked about John Muir. John James Audubon was a guy a century back that did a lot of work to popularize birding, bird watching. So this guy took detailed anatomical recreations and sketches, drawings, paintings of birds, primarily, and collected them into books. The Audubon Society is a huge bird habitat conservation organization. They do a ton of work and preserve a whole bunch of areas, and recreation includes bird watching. So they're a pretty big deal, and John James Audubon kind of got that all kicked off in the same way that John Muir got the Sierra Club kicked off. Okay, we talked about George Perkins Marsh. Let's talk about another George. George Catlin, Thomas Cole, and Albert Bierstadt. These guys were painters, and along with the transcendentalist authors Ralph Waldo Emerson, James Fenimore Cooper, and Henry David Thoreau, did a lot to set the stage for the mass media popularization of outdoor recreation. So George Catlin, Thomas Cole, and Albert Bierstadt were active in the 1800s, and what they did was paint gigantic, and by gigantic, I mean like 15 by 40 foot wide paintings of places like Rocky Mountain National Park and Yellowstone. And these sort of gigantic, huge paintings would tour the West Coast and tour the East Coast. These are basically the equivalent of National Geographic, the basic equivalent of the Nat Geo Channel, the basic equivalent of all of the beautiful sort of nature wallpaper apps on your smartphone in the mid-1800s. And so these guys helped whip up this huge groundswell of excitement for starting to set aside places like Yellowstone. Okay? So these guys very commonly tagged along on scientific or surveying expeditions run by the military or by the federal government, and would come back, and as part of their condition for being on the trip, they'd produce these gigantic paintings and help sort of build excitement and awareness of these amazing places that are in the American countryside that nobody really knew about, right? Because in the mid-1800s, we barely even have photographs, okay? So, the writers did much the same thing. So, Thoreau writing about Walden Pond, Ralph Waldo Emerson writing reams of poetry about human nature and the elegance and beauty and wisdom encapsulated in different facets of nature and so forth. James Fenimore Cooper writing about The Last of the Mohicans and so forth. And just these lavish and ornate descriptions of the countryside really helped popularize the idea and take away some of the negative stigma historically attached with wild places for religious reasons. Okay? So those guys were all pretty important. Now, notice, this is all a bunch of males. Okay? So at that time, unfortunately, we didn't really have a good sense of sort of gender equality and so forth. We're still kind of working on that in the 1800s and sort of early to mid-1900s. But with the later appearance of folks like Rachel Carson, that completely changed everything in terms of social roles. Okay? A couple other key figures. Theodore Roosevelt. We talked about him. We also talked about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So if those names sound new to you, check out the last lesson, Unit 5. All right, Gifford Pinchot, Stephen Mather, also familiar. Charles Gatie is a new one for us. So Charles Gatie's based out west in California. And what he is a very rich, or at least at that time, very rich and successful resort developer. Okay, so he has all these resorts in and near places that will later become national parks. And what he does to entertain his very well-to-do clients and customers is bring out folks like college professors, geologists, hydrologists, surveyors, and basically hire these folks to give lectures and talks and lead hikes for sort of the otherwise kind of bored resort patrons. And as a result, we have a lot of early prototyping. This guy basically financed the initial rounds of environmental interpretation out of pocket. And then what he developed, and others like him developed in Colorado at Rocky Mountain National Park, a guy named Enos Mills, basically took those lessons, and then Stephen Mather linked up with him and started applying those. He took a little bit of convincing, but started applying those techniques of bringing in experts to lead hikes and develop content for things like visitor centers and natural history museums, stuff like that. That all sort of rolled together around the same time. Okay, we also see, and this is for the veterinarians, vet techs, my wife is a veterinarian, in the class currently. So the American family pet at this time switched from sort of a utility fixture in a typical American family to, in some cases, a member of the family. It's the difference between the dog that lives outside, and you might notice it's run away after a couple of days, to the dog that lives inside and in some cases sleeps on your bed and licks you in the face in the middle of the night. Not a personal problem, but it's kind of annoying. Anyway, I digress. American family pets started showing up in huge number in the 1900s. And so that means when family goes on vacation, for a lot of these families, they're bringing their pets. And when we introduce a whole bunch of dogs in particular, but to a much lesser extent cats, to wild places where there's all kinds of wildlife, up to and including things like grizzly bears, we can sometimes run into some problems. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Up until this point, the presence of dogs in wild spaces was primarily limited to strays and to hunting animals, which were even then very expensive and typically not allowed to remain in the wild places. Okay, so that's pretty much a rapid tour through the 1900s. Now, we get into the very end, sort of the last decade of the 1900s and the 2000s and 2010s, which we're in currently. This brings us out of the confrontation phase into a phase we're currently in, the partnership phase. So, landscape management, park management, being a ranger or a superintendent, the number one person in a national park, for example, is now much more complex and difficult than it used to be, because park managers now have to cope with and deal with things like climate change, where they didn't really have to worry about that before. In pre-1950s parks, visitation was really pretty low, right? In the tens or hundreds of thousands, now we get visitation in the millions, and so in a place like Yosemite Valley, which might have 20 to 30,000 people in a relatively small space at any given time, right? That's a Carbondale in Yosemite at any given moment. You're not just a ranger, you're also a mayor and a fireman or a police officer, or someone's got to make sure that the toilet's flush and someone's got to take out the trash and provide electricity, right? So it's much more complex these days than it used to be, and as a result, we see a whole lot of different kinds of efforts for agencies to partner up with companies and not-for-profit organizations to help with managing parts that federal agencies can't do very well, okay? So we call this sort of the partnership phase. And this is an important thing because it really changes how the fundamental mechanics of outdoor recreation work under the surface. All right? The trails still look like trails. The canoes still work like canoes. But underneath the surface, it's not necessarily just the Park Service running the place. The Nature Conservancy, Ducks Unlimited, National Rifle Association, all kinds of different organizations, Friends of Acadia National Park, Friends of Shawnee National Forest, right? All kinds of different organizations, for-profit and not-for-profit, help with, in very different ways and for very different reasons, management of places. So L.L. Bean, if you've ever bought an L.L. Bean backpack or L.L. Bean boots or rain slicker or whatever, they have donated millions of dollars to Acadia National Park, which is very near their headquarters in coastal Maine. And as a result, Acadia National Park has this fabulous, what's called the Island Explorer bus system. It's free, goes all over the island. There's one coming by every 15 to 20 minutes, so you don't have to bring your car anywhere. It totally cuts down on congestion and stuff like that. Really, really, really nice bus system. But it's basically donated by a for-profit company. So that's pretty cool if you're showing up, but some people are a little bit nervous about that. We don't necessarily want corporate sponsorship of all of our parks because all money comes with strings attached, right? Fortunately, L.L. Bean has been a very benevolent overlord or donor. Okay? So, now let's take a quick look forward at some near-term trends over the next 10, 15 years. Where do we think outdoor recreation is going from right now, sort of the mid-20-teens? Okay? We're going to see a huge increase in things like synthetic alternatives to traditional forms of outdoor rec. So, if you've ever been to the climbing wall at the Student Rec Center, you know what I'm talking about. If you've ever been to a climbing gym, you know what I'm talking about. Okay? We have machinery that continuously simulates things like rock walls, right? It's like a vertical treadmill, and if you don't keep climbing, you sort of get spat out the bottom of it. All right? This is pretty cool, but it potentially has the effect of training up sport climbers, people who use bolted protection on rock faces, for example, versus traditional climbers that are placing protection into a rock face and then removing it as they go. So that's a really pretty fundamental different interaction with the resource, the rock wall, placing permanent sport anchors versus removable traditional anchors, and so forth. Right? So synthetic alternatives are a pretty big shift to how things used to operate. Another big shift we are seeing lately is supported touring. Okay, so there has always been the option available to the fabulously rich to hire guides and so forth to take you places that you might not otherwise be able to access or even know about. These days, that's become much more democratized and available to a whole lot of people. So, with things like bike touring, with things like guided hunting and fishing trips, we're seeing that all over the place now. So if you've ever wanted to hunt or fish professionally, think about being a guide based on your knowledge of forestry and ecosystems. All right. What else? Let's see. We also have seen a huge increase, and this can be good or bad, in the use of personal protective equipment. Okay, so personal protective equipment is stuff like safety glasses or safety goggles, stuff like helmets, elbow pads for sort of extreme mountain biking and stuff like that, helmets for rock climbing, more effective and functional life vests. If you think back to the old life vests you had in summer camp, for example, some of them were designed that if you're actually in the water, it would sort of hold your face down in the water. We're sort of slowly getting better at designing stuff like that, so more and more personal protective equipment is affordable, available, and custom tailored to the needs and conditions of individual kinds and settings of recreation activities. So, that's generally good, right? We want people to wear a brain bucket if you need one. On the other hand, there are some studies that suggest that having that gear makes some people, in particular young males, it's funny how that works, engage in more risky behaviors when they have that stuff on. So it's like, I've got a helmet, I can go harder, right? And that might put me in actually more danger than if I was being cautious because I didn't have a helmet. So that can be a little bit tricky, all right? Another piece that we are seeing is people going a little bit further into wild spaces based on the use and presence of personal protective equipment. So, for example, with winter sports like cross-country skiing or, in particular, downhill skiing, we're seeing people going farther and higher to go for longer ski runs with the advent of better personal protective equipment. So, for example, with avalanche probes and avalanche beacons, and avalanche lung systems, which is like a lung system. When you're buried in an avalanche, you don't typically freeze to death. You actually suffocate, which sounds like a horrible way to go. You're trapped, you can't move, you can't clear the snow away from your face, and so the carbon dioxide builds up in the interstices, or the spaces between chunks of snow, sort of right in front of your face. And there's not enough time for oxygen to exchange in so you can keep breathing. Sort of extreme snowboarders and downhill skiers had developed this equipment that basically you can breathe in from the front and you actually exhale through a tube sort of out by your hip or by your knee, for example. So there's this huge separation from where you breathe in versus where you breathe out. And you can survive for a number of hours longer that way. And then at that point, you can legitimately freeze to death, but at least you have a chance to be found and dug out. Okay. We're also seeing the rise and spread of something called dark tourism, which is sort of a ugly form of outdoor recreation where, for example, with Hurricane Katrina, there are a lot of boat tours around New Orleans. And they're lots of fun. But immediately after Hurricane Katrina, that whole area was just destroyed, right? Something like 1,800 people were killed as a result of Hurricane Katrina and its direct aftermath. So we had some of these tour boat operators, for example, accepting money to take people through the devastation. And that's kind of a dark thing. So the idea here is, why are these people enjoying the legitimate, real pain and suffering of other folks as a form of tourism? So that's kind of a new thing. And maybe it's always been around, but we're really just starting to get attuned to it in the past 10 to 15 years, in particular with Katrina. Okay. We are also seeing expanded mobility for persons of alternative or limited mobility with things like not just electric scooters and wheelchairs, but with off-road and all-terrain versions of things like Segways and electric wheelchairs with knobby tires and so forth. And adaptive and inclusive recreation for folks like amputees. If you've only got one leg, how do you go downhill skiing? Well, we've actually got harnesses for that, right? One of my recent grad students actually developed a plan and a system of rope harnesses for getting quadriplegics, people paralyzed in all four major limbs, up into trees for tree climbing courses. And it's like, how does this even work? But the gear exists, the techniques exist, and it can be safe and fun, right? So we're seeing a much more diverse array of opportunities for folks that traditionally this would never have been an option. Okay. This is important also for a lot of veterans coming back from foreign war theaters with all kinds of sort of lingering injuries, unfortunately, and so forth. Okay, we're also seeing the growth and expansion and proliferation, so the spreading of transportation infrastructure. So a lot of places that never really had roads now have roads, and that means we can bring a lot of people much more easily, quickly, and cheaply to different places. So, we'll talk about some of the ecological consequences of that, but think for a moment about some of the sort of social and experience consequences of having roads. If it feels like a real accomplishment to get way off in the hinterlands of a place like Yellowstone, like away from Old Faithful, right, where there's a road sort of right up to it and gigantic lodges right looking onto it. If it feels like accomplishment, an investment of time and effort and training and risk and exertion, to get up into the Yellowstone high country, does it cheapen that experience if we put a road up to the high country? Think about that. Are you cool with that or not so cool with it? That's kind of that confrontation phase thing that we've been talking about earlier. We also see changing exposure to risk, in particular in the forms of risk that competitive outdoor recreation can bring. So historically, stuff like surfing was just kind of lots of fun, but these days it's also regarded in some places as a sport. And with sport comes competition, and with competition comes sort of continuously increasing exposure to risk. We've got to find a bigger wave. We've got to break a record, right? It's not just enough to surf and have fun and get a tan and so forth and not drown. Competition changes the way that we look at risk in outdoor rec. New activities that we come up with, like parasailing, involve new kinds of risks and fantastically exciting ways to sort of become a quadriplegic or perished. All right. We're also seeing on the professional and technical side an expansion in stuff like dedicated machinery. So we have things like dingoes, which is kind of like a bobcat or skid steer if you're familiar with those, but it's about the size of a dishwasher. And some of them you just sort of stand behind, some of them you can sit on. but they're kind of trail size instead of road size. And so we can build a whole lot of trail very effectively using this dedicated equipment. It's kind of expensive, though. Okay? We are also seeing lots and lots and lots of new power sports. So I've got plenty of slides there. Now, so to the big final trend that I'd love to talk about here is the incorporation and spread of digital technologies in outdoor recreation. So it used to be that you had to be pretty good with a map and compass to get anywhere off of a trail. These days, a GPS can get you anywhere. And these days, we've got GPSs built into your phone, into your watch, into spot locator beacons in case you get lost. You can have a satellite uplink to let people know that you're in trouble and exactly down to the 5-meter radius of where you are. Okay, pretty cool stuff. But it also puts a screen in between you and nature. So folks are sort of wrestling with this sense of, okay, this is good that maybe a smartphone scavenger hunt app for national parks will get more people into the national parks, but maybe they'll be at the national park but not be present at the national park. So I'd really like for us to talk about this in class. We will do exactly that. Take a look at some of the other slides here for upcoming trends and so forth. And if any of those sound interesting to you, let's talk a little bit more about it in class or online at the course website. Okay? So that's it for the latter two-thirds of the 1900s and our current century. Let's see you guys in class and on the course website to talk about it.